Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Tom Hanks returns to the show to discuss his new film Here. Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 328 of Real Blend, a podcast that includes as much Spider-Man as the Venom trilogy. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend and the co-host of the Real Blend podcast. And on this week's show, Tom Hanks is back on the show. The Chuckle Club has reunited for a third time. He stars in Robert Zemeckis' film Here, and he joins the show to discuss that film, collaborations with Zemeckis in his entire career in a way that only the wonderful Tom Hanks can. I'm joined, as always, this week by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago, and in the producer's chair, Gabe Kovach. Hello, boys. How are we all doing today?
Doing well, buddy. How are you?
Hello.
I'm doing great. As you can tell from my backdrop, I'm in a different location. I don't have my fancy office around me. I'm in... What's that?
Are you in your hotel walls look like they could be a green screen.
Yeah, they could be. I'm glad I didn't have that colored shirt, which would be difficult. But of course, I only really wear black t-shirts or something that has a superhero on it. Yeah, I got chastised by the boys. So the family was in Savannah. I'm in Savannah for the SCAD Film Festival. And one of the big things we like to do down here is go to Paula Deen's restaurant. She has a very famous restaurant in the center of town. And for my family, that's become like a tradition, something that they love to do. And I wore, what did I wear? An Iron Man t-shirt. And so I showed up, I came out of the room, went downstairs to the lobby, met the boys, and PJ instantly looks at me and he goes, "For Paula Deen's, you're gonna wear an Iron Man." And they're in very nice polos and they're dressed ready to go. And I said, "PJ, you gotta understand, like, this is dressed up for me." From now on,
every time I see you dressed down, I'm just going to go, "For Paula Deen's." I just realized that it's not just a black shirt. It's a Wolverine shirt. It says Wolverine on it.
It is a Wolverine shirt. This
it's
is
a classy Wolverine shirt.
Classy.
The Deadpool Wolverine junket, which I got this shirt from. So, hello. If you're watching us on YouTube, thank you very much for joining us. Hopefully you guys are here because you have heard some of our previous episodes with Tom Hanks, maybe you're fans of the way we interview him. Met Hanks for the very first time Real Blend officially did on the Elvis junket. He had such a good time. He came back around for A Man Called Otto. And so now that he has Here coming to theaters, he reached out and asked if he can come on the show. And of course, we're not going to turn Tom Hanks down. Kev, of the three, which one is your favorite? What's your favorite Hanks?
They're all special for certain reasons. My favorite one, hands down, is the one we did in person for Elvis because we just the interview went in such a different direction than we had even planned for it to. And I don't know, did the time frame of that, wasn't he like late for a meeting with was it Priscilla Presley?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were going to do a screening of it where they had to introduce a screening that evening. So he was running to that.
And he stayed longer for the interview with us.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it was him, but also just all of us being there.
Yeah.
In person, the photo we all took together, the stories that he told. I mean, the second one is iconic as well because of we were just all like punch drunk, meaning that like, you know, it was like late in London and
we just had a day with James Cameron at the Avatar junket. Right. Like we'd all like just come off of that day and it was just a weird amalgamation of things.
Yeah. And clarifying what I mean by that is punch drunk is the show was in London. Tom Hanks was in L.A. and we were all just like barely on any sleep, us three.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just like, it was just so much fun.
And weirdly enough, I'm back in London for the third one.
Yes, you are. Yeah, back in another hotel room. For that first one, too, there's something special about us. We did so, not to pat ourselves on the back, but we did so well that it almost like convinced him like, oh, this is a show that I'm kind of interested in. And then Otto was the one that finally put the hooks in.
Yeah. Well, when you bring up the Flying Nun, I mean, I think you earn a level of respect that.
Absolutely true. Well, as you will hear in this interview, he refers to us as a poor man's selfless. Smartless.
Actually, selfless podcast is the name of our show now. Yeah. That's the poor man's smartless.
Which I think is hilarious. And he's very quick to point out that we were founded first. So we should ask them for a licensing fee. If you're watching us on YouTube, thank you very much. Hit subscribe, turn on your notifications. We have officially crossed the 40,000 subscriber mark, which is incredible. Thank you guys so much for all your support. We really, really appreciate it. If you're listening to us in audio format, it's youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. This is when you're going to want to watch. It's Tom Hanks back with us. Of course, you're available. We are available all the places you get your podcast needs met. And if you would like some Real Blend Premium this week, you're going to get a newsletter from me and you get an ad-free version of the show. But basically, you guys are here for Tom Hanks. So without further ado, this is good friend of the show, Tom Hanks, joining us to talk about his new film Here with Robin Wright and directed by Robert Zemeckis.
Oh, there they are. One, two, three. Wow. Oh, man. Paul Linda Block. This is like a look at you. Look at you guys. You are like a poor man smartless podcast. This is, you know.
They did steal their idea from us.
I'm going to say, who came first? You know.
You came first.
I think you should ask for a licensing fee. Good to see you, Cats.
Someone get Bateman on the phone now.
Good to see you also, Tom. How are you?
It's always a pleasure. You guys know films and you like films. So this is all we're doing is sitting around talking about movies.
Very true.
This is what I do all day long anyway. So hit it.
Best job in the world.
When we talked on the Elvis press day, you teased us at that time that you were about to do a film that was going to use, as you called it, a super-powered lens, a billion-dollar lens that you can find in an iPad. And you asked the director, you know, how are we going to do this? And he explained it to you. And we said, well, who is that going to be? And you were like, I signed an NDA and my life is on the line, essentially.
Did I really say that? Okay.
You did, yeah. So afterwards, the three of us said to each other, like, it's got to be Zemeckis. Has to be Zemeckis at this point. So it was this film that you were teasing?
Yeah, it was, because we were still talking about the graphic novel existed.
Yes.
And I had to read it like four times in order to figure out what was. Have you guys seen the graphic novel?
No.
Okay, it's very cinematic and it's very reflective of the movie that Bob ended up making. So that was one aspect of it. But then we were in the midst of wrestling the double-headed Hydra of certainly the technology, as created DNA wise in the graphic novel. But along with that then came the how do we act and examine the theme in what would appear to be this very, very limiting, you know, confines. You say, yeah, as soon as you say something like ludicrous, like, well, the lens doesn't move. That's true on the most basic level. But time flies by. Everything else is in constant flux on the screen. And I have found myself trying to explain it, you know, before it came out, or, you know, about when we were doing it, or just when we were in London. What are you working on? Oh, I'm out at Pinewood and I'm doing this movie with Bob Zemeckis called Here. Why is it called Here? And I have to say, well, oh, first of all, it's Here, H-E-R-E, not H-E-A-R. You know, that's right. That's one aspect of it.
Yeah.
But then it talks about how life is only lived in one place at one time, and that's right here. But the movie covers the entire breadth of humanity. so that is a long way of going to trying to explain something that you understand probably within 17 seconds of the movie. Am I wrong? So
no,
as soon as you see
true.
What we've done, it all makes sense. And the contract that a movie has with the audience is the same contract that any movie has with its audience. Here's the world. Here's the logic. Here's the narrative. Just hold on to your hat so you'll be able to figure all this stuff out.
Now, if you could, how does it affect your preparation when you know constantly where the camera is going to be and is not moving?
I stopped paying attention to the camera a long time ago. At the same time, knowing exactly what the confines are. Does that make sense? You know, I'm familiar with the physical, mental, call it even spiritual discipline of standing on a mark, you know, trying to tell the truth in a very specific amount of time. All right. That's the gig. And if you can't do it, get out of the business. And a lot of people can kind of fake their way through it. Knowing that we weren't going to have any of that self-knowledge luxury in doing this, because we knew the frame is this big, it's this deep, it's this room. We will have to do things like find our own close-ups, walk into very specific positions, not camera positions, acting positions. And we did a workshop of it for about a week and a half to see how we would actually make this work. We had a mock-up and we locked off a camera and we did all that stuff. We worked on it like crazy. But then when we got into doing it, this idea that, you know, Bob said, yeah, it's going to be kind of like doing theater. But I've done theater and it's not. It's not like doing theater at all, because theater does stuff with, you know, lights and specials, and there's an entire different sort of, excuse me, a union between the proscenium with live actors on it and an audience. What this is much more like, guys, is the films of the 30s, 40s, and 50s that just shot without a lot of coverage. If you're going to go back and look at certainly scenes from, just take great movie, Casablanca, scenes from Citizen Kane, scenes from any Preston Sturges movie, scenes between, like, there's a great scene between Cary Grant and James Stewart in The Philadelphia Story. I don't know if you know. And here's what happens in those scenes. The camera does not move. Everybody else does. There's constant motion. And the exchange of ideas is very quick. There's not a lot of lingering. There's no pausing, because there's no place to put scissors in, because no one's going to cut to a cutaway and then come back. Yeah. So it exists in this other kind of movie time that enjoys this benefit. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Deep focus.
Yeah.
You're in the foreground and you are sharp. You're as far away in the set as you can be. You are still sharp. Wow. Which means you are working anybody in that frame. If there's two people, or if there's 23, we have some big scenes in this. Everybody is visible. Everybody is lit. Everybody is recognizable. And so, therefore, no one is not working for the 2 minutes of that scene, or the, you know, minute and 17 seconds of that scene. And the only job we end up having is to get it so right that's the version that's going to be in the movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
We would do 42 takes of a 2 minute scene. Now, sometimes the takes would fall apart, and, you know, we had these, you know, risers and slide ins and all this kind of stuff that would go along. And sometimes that would fall apart. But at the end of the day, at the end of that scene, for the better part of a half a day shooting, we'd have maybe 22 complete versions of that scene, all right? And there is a huge difference between a scene that takes 2 minutes and 17 seconds to play and a scene that takes 2 minutes and 2 seconds to play. Sometimes 4 seconds between one timing or another would be the difference. Bob would talk about this thing that Frank Capra wrote about. And it makes sense, because take a look at a movie like It's a Wonderful Life. How many scenes in that movie are locked off, the camera does not move, and yet everybody else does, right?
Right.
There is this thing that happens in the speed with which you think you are performing being way too fast. No pausing, right on the one dialogue begins right after, no holding for your cues. It's amazing how that can seem too fast in real life, but as soon as you see it projected onto a bigger screen, the same scene plays slower. And it just all makes kind of sense. And look, and that's a beast that we had to wrestle with over and over again. And we never were able to say, oh, we know how to do this now, because it was different and unique every one of those scenes because of the stuff that happened to happen inside it.
That's incredible. Thank you so much.
Do you want to be the fourth host of this show? Because my God, are you good? Are you the perfect guest? You have no idea how much you're the perfect guest of this show.
Look, who doesn't want to get together? Like we said, we're just talking about movies, man. Right, you know, right. That's all. Let's compare notes. That's all we're doing.
We never could have had that conversation in a TV slot. That's why I love us this time. Yeah, that's why I appreciate
you. Wait,
you
didn't talk about Preston Sturges and all the other rooms today?
I did, actually. And oh, okay, no, good. By the way, sometimes went blank. Who? What? Blank. That's why you got to throw in like Casablanca and, you know, the Philadelphia story.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mr. Hanks, all of your collaborations that you've done with Mr. Zemeckis are obviously such big swings. There are no safe films between the two of you. And I'd imagine that there's just so much trust that's been built up over the last 30 years. I'm sort of curious, over the course of your three decades working together, what's your favorite piece of direction you've ever received from Mr. Zemeckis? Your favorite note that you've ever gotten from him?
Now, if I told you this story, you could just raise your hand. But there was a moment on each one of these movies, but the primordial beat came from on our first film. This is now a question we don't ask ourselves anymore. But I asked Bob, is anybody going to care about this guy? We were on a park bench in Cherokee Square in Savannah. We had been shooting all these scenarios with other actors. I'm in this very particular suit. I've got a suitcase there. There was so much dialogue that I said, look, I'm going to have to rehearse on these things on cue cards so that I could get them, because I can't have memorized 12 pages of dialogue the night before. It's just not going to happen. So we were doing it in this kind of very specific kind of like fluid manner. And at one point we were changing over for one of the other scenarios with, you know, there was the nurse and there was the guy, you know, and there was the old lady. And we're trying to figure out the specifics of what part of the story that we're telling and what the dialogue says, and Bob's trying to work on what the cuts are, and the sun is going down. We only have like the morning to get it, the whole bit. And I said to Bob, is anybody going to care about this? We had just come from working on about half the movie, where we ran all over the country and we had shot Vietnam and we had done all this other kind of stuff. And here we are trying to do this. Is this wraparound even going to work? I mean, what's the narrative? And Bob just said, it's a minefield, Tom. We're sowing the seeds for our own destruction every time we roll the camera. And that hearing that is like, now that's not a cynical perspective on the process. What he was really saying is, all we can do our best and like what we have, you know, and then see what happens when it comes down to Vox Populi. That is the truth for all of these movies. You do not know if you are in fact sowing the seeds of a beautiful garden that will feed the multitudes, or of your own destruction. You do not know. And that's not saying it's a crapshoot. What that's saying is, Is the collaborative process here going to capture an unseen zeitgeist, right, that everybody will recognize as being a part of? And I think all of the movies that we've done, again, of course, The Polar Express was such a deep throw because we were dealing with a whole different technique and whole different thing. And Bob was saying, we don't even have to figure out what the camera's doing when we shoot it, because I'll do that later on, you know, when they go to what they called digital wheels at the time. Yeah. And when we did Castaway, we got to the island and, you know, we had a different sort of screenplay in there, because in order to help people understand what's going on, you know, Chuck Nolan spoke all the time. What am I going to do now? Well, what do you think? And we got to the island and literally the very first shot, we say, you know, Bob, I don't see any reason for Chuck to talk here unless he thinks somebody is there. And Bob said, well, that'd be great, because you're not really going to have any lines until Wilson shows up. I said, perfect, you know. And that's the type of thing. Are we capturing the zeitgeist there? Or have we just sown the seeds of our own destruction? And all of the stuff that we've done on here has been taking that into account and forgetting that there is a danger there. Because what more can you do except plow ahead?
Yeah,
wow. True.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
So this year I turned 40, and it's like for the first time in my life, I'm really kind of thinking about time in a very different way.
You're right on time.
I know. And it's funny how it happens. And your character talks about time flying by and this idea. And I was just curious for you, over your years in your own life and even also as an actor, how your perspective as time has changed over the different decades, you know, how you view time now versus how you viewed it back then.
We have, look, those of us who have been, you know, making movies, we have this harsh reminder that comes our way periodically. Sometimes it's we go and talk to somebody and they show a clip of a movie we made when we were 27 years old. That's a harsh moment. Yeah. For the regular folks that might put in an old family video or have, you know, photographs in the house of where they did. I have moving pictures of captured time. You know, I can look at any one of these old clips. I don't necessarily, matter of fact, we just did that. Somebody else showed us a clip from Forrest Gump. I had no memories of what happened in it. I remember shooting it. I remember where we did. I remember the smells. But I did not remember the story beats that was nailed in there. So it all becomes some sort of like, I think, like Martian time slip for a guy like me. I'm 68. I know I've made a lot of movies. I know I've also forgotten a ton of them. But I am very much aware of, number one, having done this a long time. Number two, what I feel great about those scenes, those moments where maybe we did sow our seeds of our own destruction. But what has never been removed is the genuine power that is timeless of somebody's individual relationship with that one movie that I saw. You know, I will tell you, in the movie Sully that I made with Clint Eastwood, there is a scene where the plane is coming in low over the Hudson as it's about to, you know, land in the river. And somebody came up to me and said, I have to tell you, Mr. Hanks, when I saw Sully, that moment when the plane is flying over the Hudson River, he said, I saw the planes fly into the World Trade Center. And it took me right back to that moment. Oh. That is a power of cinema. And as soon as I told you guys that memory, where did you guys go in your head? Where you were. And how you saw that on that day.
Yeah. Sure.
You can't deny that power, and you can't celebrate it, and you can't bottle it. All you can do is kind of like just bow down in some brand of humble submission to the power of these movies that now never go away. They will last and be seen again. Right now, someone is watching Sully somewhere in the world. Sure. The same way right now, someone is watching Cloud Atlas somewhere in the world, or, you know, some other movie that, you know, some other movie that are made. And ain't that the reason we go into this business in the first place? Even just to have the chance to talk about it.
There was a great scene in that movie Babylon where Gene Smart says to Brad Pitt that in 100 years, someone's going to turn one of your movies on and you're going to come back to life. And that is it kind of what you're saying, the idea of like you will live forever in that way. And I do wonder what that feels like to know in 100 years someone's going to turn you come back to life.
You know, it's interesting. I was watching an old movie on Turner Classic Movie. I'm going to say it was called Angels with Dirty Faces. You know, something with James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. Yeah. And there was a scene that was shot on the back lot that I have since walked along, you know, the back lot at maybe Paramount, I can't remember. But anyway, one of the back lots at Warner Brothers or whatnot. And in this scene shot on the back lot, there were probably 120 extras that were hired that day, right? There's cars, there's buses, there's horses and taxi cabs, there's kids playing stickball, there's people walking up and down like crazy, there's people hanging out of the windows, right? And I was looking at this in the farthest building in the facade in the background, in one of the higher windows, a lady was told on action to take her sheet, whip it, wave it like she's drying it, and then hang it on a clothesline. on the thing. And I just thought, that actress, that actor, had a day on a movie at Warner Brothers. And every time she ever saw that movie, she saw herself waving a sheet, and she was that big. She was tiny in the frame. And I also then thought, her kids could see that movie for the rest of their lives and know that, hey, that's mom. Their grandkids, hey, your grandmother was an actress and she worked in this one movie. She could see her waving a sheet. That beat will never, ever, ever, ever go away. And so that individual person has a memory that will not only last a lifetime, but be passed on to others and will be frozen in time forever. She comes back to life every time someone plays Angels with Dirty Faces. Isn't that just the coolest thing in the world? It's like being able to go and see, you know, a masterpiece painting that is still in a museum somewhere. Still right there, still speaks to absolutely everybody.
I'll tell you what, I've said to Jake recently that I think that this dumb show has value because my kids someday will be able to go wherever it lives and turn it back on. I would kill to have video footage of my father now. You know?
Like, hello, yeah. And I'm going to confound you now. If you go back and look, how long has this cockamamie show of yours been on TV? Well, how long?
Six years.
Yeah. Go back to your third episode, right? And see what you can remember of what you said versus what the other two guys said.
Do
that little test. And then all of you three guys argue about what happened during the show. You'll all have three different versions of what that show was like.
To your point, when people bring up like, oh, this interview moment when you guys did this, I will look at the other guys and go, I don't know what the hell they're talking about.
What is that?
Tom, you couldn't have set me up better when you mentioned these things popping up, these pivotal moments, because I love the inclusion in here of the Beatles playing All My Loving on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it happens during a very pivotal moment in Richard's life, and they're almost not even paying attention to it, right? Like, it's just a distraction in the background. So I need to know, do you remember where you were the moment that happened?
I was in apartment 114 of the Buena Vista Park Apartments in Alameda, California. I was watching with my brother and sister. And here's the thing, are you ready for this?
Sure.
Funny, because I'm kind of writing about this moment because it's quite seminal. On Friday, our teacher, Mrs. Castle, in second grade, said, "Hey, listen, when all you guys watch this new band on the Ed Sullivan Show that everybody's talking about, just understand they're not really going to be playing. Backstage, a stagehand will drop a needle in one of their records, and they will mouth the words, pretending they're singing. Because that's the way it worked at that time, right? But then as soon as they started singing All My Lovin', I said, no, they're not. That's live. I know what All My Lovin' sounds like. This is a horrible mix, and it's actually happening in real time, and they're really playing. And it was a weird thing. It's like, hey, my teacher is wrong? Oh, my Lord, if you can't trust Mrs. Castle to tell you the truth, then change everything. But, you know, you're talking about something. We put just as much thought into what was playing on the TV in here as anything. Because, I think there's one where we're watching the Jackie Gleason show with Crazy Guggenheim. That means that scene took place on a Saturday, watching the Jackie Gleason show. There's another one where I think we have Dean Martin playing, right? On the Dean Martin variety show. That means that happened on Thursday night. Between 10 and 11. So all of this stuff goes into the tapestry of placing a moment in a very specific place and time, just as much as it is a place in geography.
I love it. That's great.
Wow. Tom, this might be a strange question, but I'm going to say that I know you're looking off going, oh no. Every time you and Mr. Zemeckis make a film together, I'm incredibly grateful that it exists. I'm so happy that it happens. There's one film that you guys did not make together that I'm, with all due respect, happy that it doesn't exist. And that was, I've always heard stories that they really wanted you guys to make a Forrest Gump sequel.
Yeah. And
there's the book, and I know that there's even a scene where I think he meets you.
Yeah.
But I'm very grateful. I'm sort of curious what you remember about you being in the position to be able to say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Well, the Winston Groom did write another version of it, but it was, his first book was very different from what it was, a real great interpretation. And in fact, there was a version of a second Eric Roth and Bob and I, and we got together, and Eric had sort of like mapped out what the second one could be, right? And you know, on what the studio actually said, what are you guys allergic to money? That's one of the things they said. What you guys don't want us to pull a dump truck up to your house and unload, you know, nickels, you know, and nickels, dimes, and quarters?
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, okay, well, you know, we don't know what it would be. And so we got together and talked about what the possibilities could possibly be. And here's what we could do. We could come up with a story. We could come up with a plot. We could come up with things that happened, you know, to the characters. We could come up with something that would work. But that was the only meeting we ever had about it, because when it was done, we just said, this remains unnecessary. Why would we try to continue a story that came to its own complete and proper conclusion? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it talked about, never going to happen.
And so is it okay that I say, it sounds weird, is it okay that I say that I'm happy that it didn't happen?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely so. But I'm going to tell you right now, here's how many things have changed. We could have like wanted to make this movie now, and we would have had to sign a contract guaranteeing a sequel, you know, for some sort of movie. Because that's kind of like intellectual property now is absolute king when it comes down to green lighting films. So I don't know. We always have this conversation. Could we even get away with making Forrest Gump now? Story-wise, you know, maybe some aspect of, you know, who Forrest is. But I don't think a studio would allow it without some version of a guaranteed next one somehow.
So we're getting a sequel to here called There.
Yeah. Well,
dang,
you know.
Come on.
Yeah, we didn't sign that contract either, so we're all right.
two of the biggest stars of this film are off camera, in my opinion, Don Burgess and Alan Silvestri. And obviously Don shot Forrest Gump, you know, and Alan Silvestri, one of the greatest composers of all time.
God, the score is so good.
To sit here and to think about the music that your performances have been set to throughout your career is remarkable to me. And we've talked a bit about score before. You mentioned Apollo 13 and things like that, not really wanting to see everything until the final product. But I was just curious, as we sit here right now and you look at your body of work, thinking about what Alan Silvestri did here, what are pieces of score that have come to mind that emotionally moved you when you finally saw the product of your performance set to them? Because that's got to be a very special emotional relationship that you have as an actor.
Yeah.
To hear that. I'm just curious which ones come to mind.
Well, what I love about it, it is another artist's interpretation of the theme that I have nothing to do with. You know, it is somebody else saying, here's how I can be part of the additive process to it. And two very big, a lot of them, you know, look, I had Johnny Williams for, you know, Saving Private Ryan and whatnot. But I was on the recording stage for Apollo 13 for James Horner's recording of the reentry to Earth sequence. And I could only listen to it once, because you hear the live orchestra, right? And then you see it playing up in the thing. I could only hear it once because I burst into tears because it was so powerful and so heavy. And later on, you see how also his theme for the launch was so filled with majesty and hope and gravitas. The other one was certainly hearing the opening theme that Alan Silvestri did to Over the Feather with Forrest Gump. There's a type of thing, on one hand, you're listening to it because you want to hear the work of it, but then it gets just lost in the perfection of how appropriate and natural it is. So on one hand, you're hearing it, but on the other hand, it's just another part of the experience to go along with the picture. So those guys, I don't even begin to understand how somebody scores it. But there's also this other thing that particularly Alan Silvestri did with Bob, and that is where not to put the score. There's one specific place in Forrest just before he starts running across the country that other people would say, and I think Bob even said to Alan, "What, you don't think there should be a cue here?" And Alan said, "I wouldn't touch this scene with music for $1 million." And so when there is no music, and then it becomes part of the storytelling process too, because you notice there's no Alan Silvestri score when Chuck is on that island. You don't hear any music until he is at sea afterwards. And that absence of score is as important as is the presence of it.
All right, Tom, I'm going to get out of here on this last one. There's a line that's delivered in here that I have to believe means something. It was Paul Bettany saying, "Get a job where you get a suit." I have to believe you have received that advice and maybe since have given that advice. Is that true?
Nah. My dad once told me that they were hiring at Jack in the Box and I should take the job because any idiot could make assistant manager in 6 months. And I thanked him for his vote of confidence. There is that school of thought that says, get a job where you get to sit, you know, and get a job where you do wear a suit. What is hilarious is I actually made that decision when I realized that I had a shot of paying my rent by being an actor. And in the back of my head, I thought, I will never have to put on a suit and go to work and wear that dress code. And of course, what are a ton of the movies that I've been in? Guys who wear suits that I had to go and go through massive long, you know, costume fittings in order to get the perfect suit. And then to report it on, I've got to have, you know, an expert come in and recuff it. And all day long, they're adjusting my suit and making my, Tom, tuck your shirt in, Tom, stand up straight, doing all this kind of stuff. And you end up hating, absolutely hating the suit, knowing that I became an actor so I'd never have to wear a suit and go to work.
They were kicking us out, Mr. Hanks. We really appreciate you coming back on. It's all always right. A pleasure talking with
Manny,
you.
Manny, Mo, Jack, Larry, Mo, Curly, Joe, Shep, love you all. Good to see you. Tinkers to Evans to Chance, man. You guys are one badass triple play. Always a pleasure to talk movies with you.
The Chuckle Club loves you, sir.
The Chuckle Club. See you guys.
Thank you, Tom.
We want to thank our good friends at Sony and, of course, Tom Hanks for continuing to return to the Real Blend podcast, where I can genuinely say that I believe he has a good time when he comes on this show. I think he enjoys coming on the show. He said to me in my typewritten letter, I think he probably gave some you guys some sort of sentiment of this as well, too. He said, so long as you continue to ask interesting questions, you will forever have a guest in me. Oh. And, you know, that's fantastic because, Jake, you say this almost all the time. Like, he gave up doing junkets. He essentially stopped doing junkets for several years and, you know, has been coaxed back to do a few, you know. But even when he comes around and does something like a press day for A Man Called Otto or a press day for Here, he's not doing a ton.
So it's always very
time.
It's a very limited. I think his days of doing the full tour, as it were, are done. But yeah, whenever I started out doing junkets, I always used to tell people, like, oh my God, my dream is to interview Tom Hanks. And everyone go, sorry, dude. Like, you know, same thing with Clooney. Clooney stopped for a long time. Clooney wasn't doing, you know, how many George Clooney directed movies did we do junkets for not to get Clooney? So a lot of these guys are kind of starting to make their way back around. But there's sort of that thing. There's that responsibility that we have, which is to show them, like, hey, if you're going to come back around, let's ask you the kind of questions that'll keep you here. And knock on wood, I think we have not to pat ourselves on the back.
What do you, Kev, do you think for F1 next summer that Pitt does a lot of press? I mean, movie.
It's tough. I don't know. I mean, like. I don't know, because Brad Pitt, from what I saw with him and Clooney for that movie Wolfs, right? I don't think they did anything outside of a carpet or a couple of sit downs. They did a Kimmel bit, and I think they did like a red carpet. But
yeah,
they're the two stars of that movie, and whatever money that movie cost.
Kev, for F1, are they going to refer to his global tour as Pit Stops?
Oh, come on. Wow, I feel Gabe like Dave has been saving that.
You guys.
It just came to me, actually.
You guys missed a zinger from Gabe on the break. So glad to get that audio over there. Yeah, no, I only brought that up because, like, he reminds me of another one who is, like, tough to get now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Doesn't do a ton of press. And that movie is marketed on him.
Yeah. And at one point, I mean, look, I think the story about the budget, what it was like 200 to something more than 200. At what point does the studio have to step in and say, listen, I get you don't do junkets anymore, but this. We spent $250 million on your face.
I think that's
get your ass out there and do junkets.
I think it's done before he makes the movie. I would imagine that, like, whatever press obligations he has to do for that film.
I always thought that too, but then how often do we hear, like, from studios, like, oh, you know, we're getting pushback from the team, and, you know, we're being told that they're not doing this amount of press and that amount of press. And there's even a junket that we have coming up that I'm not going to name, where, like, not everyone's getting the lead stars, you know, like it's I'll text you. So it's I don't know. I thought that too. I thought it was worked into the contract, but I don't know.
Strangely, I'm getting Russell Crowe for Gladiator 2. Yeah. I don't understand what we're going to talk about. It's going to be unusual.
Yeah. He loves being asked questions about Gladiator 2.
His rep just reached out.
He loves it. I saw a clip on YouTube yesterday where it was like someone asked him about Gladiator 2, and he was like basically saying, why aren't I getting paid for all the questions I'm being asked about a movie I'm not even in?
I mean, it is a fair question. It's not like there, you know, there are some times where, yeah, you can audit, you can actually say, okay, like, what does that person mean asked that? But it's a fair question, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, no? that's neither here nor there. And speaking of here.
Cha-cha-cha. You guys are on today, man.
I don't understand. Well, that's okay. So here is getting terrible reviews.
Sure. Like, I knew walking out. I thought of the three of us, I was going to be the only one that liked it.
That's what I was going to say. Like, initially I was about to say, I'm shocked that it's getting panned, but at the same time, I'm not. I think that it is. I think it's a very easy film to knock. If you come at it from a cynical point of view.
Wait, it's being panned
big time.
It is at 32%, but it's only 22 reviews, but 32%.
So here's what I'll say about here. For anyone who doesn't know the general premise of it, it is the camera does not move. It is locked in one spot. It is covering an entire breadth of stories for things that take place at this one given location. And this goes from anything to when the asteroid hits the Earth. And the dinosaurs are affected by it, through such periods as, you know, colonial America, the Revolution. It largely follows this one family that initially starts with Paul Bettany, and then Tom Hanks is Paul Bettany's son, and then Tom Hanks takes over the house. So that's the heart of the movie, but we go into the future a little bit, we go deep into the past, and you periodically touch in on these other characters in these bit of subplots. I can see how, if the premise doesn't work for you from the get-go, that the movie might end up becoming annoying. But I was completely on board with the premise. I loved the way that Zemeckis visually figured out how to move you through the eras. And as you will hear in an interview that we do with Robert Zemeckis next week, that'll be on the show, this is an adaptation of a graphic novel. And so he took the idea of, like, panels. So you're watching, say, like a scene with Tom Hanks and Robin Wright, and then in the lower right hand corner, the same room, there'd be a panel that would come up, and you'd see in the panel in the box that it's the same room, but at a different time frame. And then, like, a few more panels might show up, and then you transition into the other time frame. And I thought all that was seamless. Like, it was very easy for me to follow what storyline we were in. It was very easy for me to transition in and out of those. And I thought there was enough the balance between the earlier stories, not inconsequential, but the stories that weren't the Tom Hanks or the Paul Bettany ones, there was just enough of them that I was never like, all right, why are we back here again? You know, I thought they all made sense. And so the balance of all of that, I thought, worked out really well. And I was completely engrossed in the central story of what was going on in the lives of the characters played by Tom Hanks and Robin Wright. I know there's a lot of stuff being made about the reunion of all the Forrest Gump people, but to me, they're just completely different movies. You know, like, I think that this is a very sort of intimate character study. Forrest Gump is obviously this epic sort of sprawling American story. And I thought that they just did incredible work. I wasn't distracted at all by the de-aging of the characters. I thought all that was really done well. I thought Paul Bettany does really, really good work as the father who's a veteran who's come home from war and is dealing with life not necessarily going the way that he wants it to go. And I just was wrapped up in the story. So I came out of this, by the end of it, emotionally, I was a wreck, you know, and I really thought it hit the emotional beats that it was going for. But Jake, elaborate a little bit on that, like on how you kind of did predict that it wasn't going to maybe be as well received as.
I just had this feeling, honestly, about halfway through where I thought, I am loving this and I am going to be the only one. Really? It makes me really happy that you guys loved it. I agree. You use the exact word. If a cynical person, I think a lot of people walked into this movie having already decided that they didn't like it. I think a lot of people have been sharpening their pitchforks for this one for a while. Look, we talk about this a lot. A good movie makes you think and reflect deeply on the characters. I think a great movie oftentimes makes you think and reflect deeply on yourself. I mean, I challenge anyone to see this movie and not think about their childhood living room, you know, everything that happened in just in your life. And I mean, I think of my childhood living room. There was a family. I know that I know of the family that lived there before us. And I don't know who's there now, but I know someone's there now because last time I was in Houston, I drove by the house and I saw other people in my driveway. And it's a weird feeling, you know, like someone's living their life in that place where I lived my life. But like, no, that's my place, you know, and that's such a universal feeling. It's such a strange feeling, but one that a lot of people have, you know. Even here in Chicago, there are different apartments that I've lived in that I've lived monumental moments in my life that now someone else is there, you know. The place that I'm sitting right now, someone lived here before me. And I don't understand how that's not a relatable concept for people. And I think it's handled so well. I will say that, like, I do think some stories worked better than others. It goes through a couple of different stories. There's one that like features the inventor of the Lazy Boy that I sort of think like I could have probably done without this one. But it was never so it didn't stay with it long. And it was never like so off-putting that I was waiting for it to end. Like I was just sort of like, okay, well, let's see where this one goes. It's just one that I like less than the other ones. But the main core story very much worked for me. I thought it moved really briskly for a camera that quite literally doesn't move. And then, yeah, you mentioned the de-aging. Look, I feel like everyone's kind of sleeping on a technology that has been ripped apart for the last, 15 years? And now all of a sudden we got a movie where I forgot that it was being used. And isn't that the point? Isn't that great special effects where you forget that they're there? Like it wasn't until after the movie, I was like, oh wait, they did de-age them. Like, oh shit, I forgot. Like great, great job. I didn't think about it. As opposed to Kevin, you know, you and I often talk about, you know, like Irishman, like they probably should have just done something else. But right. this movie very much worked for me. I'm really bummed that it's not working for everybody else because I feel like you're missing out on what should be a very relatable, raw, authentic kind of movie experience. I don't know. Kev, what do you think?
Yeah, I loved it. I think it's some of the best de-aging I've seen. And I think Robin Wright spoke a lot about the idea of the innocence in their eyes and as characters, because when you de-age somebody, you know, you have to essentially erase the history that person has lived.
Oh, wow. That's a great
right?
point.
And so Robin Wright talked a lot about the idea that, like, when she saw herself as the younger version, she saw, I think Tom Hanks used the word jaded, because as we get older in life, we experience so much. And there's an innocence to our eyes that we would have when we're 19, 20 years old. And I'm just paraphrasing kind of what Robin and Tom were talking about. But there is something fascinating to think about when you look at the de-aging, because it is a person who hasn't experienced these later years of their lives. And I think that de-aging looks incredible in the story. And I think one of the things I do love is Don Burgess, who shot the film, who shot Forrest Gump as well. The frame is so interesting because it's one frame, one lens, essentially one camera angle for the film. And they have to have deep focus for foreground, middle ground and background. And what's interesting about that is all the actors are different heights. So I don't know if did you guys hear about the Bettany Trench?
No.
Oh, so this is kind of cool. So I think Paul Bettany's like 6 foot something, whatever. So if Paul Bettany is coming closer to the camera and has to do something closer to the camera, they had to build a trench that he would walk down unnoticed. Yeah. So because the frame doesn't change, every actor has to be fitting in that frame, no matter how close or far they are away from the image.
Wow.
So you had, there were elements where actors were having to either walk up a ramp, walk down a ramp. There was a trench built for Bettany. So Bettany spends a lot of time, if you look at the frame, in like a, there's an alcohol cabinet to the left of the frame. And because he's so tall, there's no way he can walk that close to the camera without his head being cut off by the frame.
You know how hard it must have been to not tilt? Like just a simple tilt to keep everybody framed. Right.
And think about that. Like, and so like every actor, as they get closer or further away, like the rehearsing and the blocking of all that has to be done prior. If the movie's basically filled with mini oneers. Right,
because if you think about all the scenes, like a stage play, kind of.
Yeah, like a minute 15.
But I love how Hank's pointed out, like it's not theater. You know how different it is from theater.
Yeah,
right. Because I thought that too, and then he kind of shot that notion down.
And the vignettes are fascinating, and I agree that some of the, not all the stories work, but what I found really genuinely fascinating, like Jake was saying, like to think about like the place I'm sitting in right now, and like you know you wonder where what happened, and. I've lived in three or four different houses in my lifetime, you know, like growing up and then in my current age. And I always wondered, like I would go back to my old houses, drive by them, and I would want to go up to the door and ask, mm-hmm. can I come in and see how you set the place up? Like, what does it look like? How did you set my old house up? what does it look like in there?
And
like,
I was just
it's
telling
so
Sean,
interesting.
Like, I follow this Twitter account that's like old pictures of Chicago because I think it's really cool because Chicago is obviously such an old city that it's really cool to sort of like look around where I'm at and sort of see what buildings look like back in the day. And a picture came up from, I think, like the year 2000 or 2001. And where I'm sitting right now, the apartment building where I'm sitting in, this used to be a golf course. They had like a 4 or 5 hole golf course downtown. So in like my version of here, there would be a storyline of like guys on the golf course. And then there would be like an apartment building built. And that's just within the last 25 years here in Chicago. Like imagine, you know, and that's it's such a great idea.
My old house was built on a golf course. My old house.
Oh, wow.
Being here,
really?
Yeah.
Being here in Savannah. So I'll transition to that now. The amount of history that's in this city is insane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, you walk around downtown Savannah and you'll read a plaque where you're next to a church that is, you know, still essentially the replica of the church from when it was built. Mm-hmm. And it'll tell you that George Washington attended church there.
Wow.
Wow.
Like that's how far back you're going. And you're looking at this piece of history.
You knew George Washington, so like
I did.
What's interesting about Sean is Sean has been here for all these years.
Sean's here. He's in all the stories.
Sean's the cameraman.
Yeah, like he's been running the camera
for thousands of years. He's the one sitting in the spot doing that.
That's why Bob Zemeckis didn't understand my questions because he was like, "Weren't you there?"
It's like it goes back to like the old Ben Franklin story, and it's like Sean with like one of those curly white wigs.
Sean has been in that spot for thousands of years since
it's really hilarious. You guys are great. I told the dinosaurs to move. Move, guys, move. This thing's coming in. It's going to hit. You guys got to move. So three high recommendations from here. Don't believe the other reviews.
One other thing I want to say is Alan Silvestri's score as well. Like there's so much like I think performance wise, like there's just something so devastating and beautiful about what the film says about time. And I think for me, time is probably the most emotional tool I find used in cinema. That's why I love Chris Nolan so much. I mean, you think about the way time is used in Interstellar when he's watching his kids grow up. I mean, there is something devastating about watching time pass in films and knowing what's lost and remaining in time. And to me, that's what really makes I think I'm a sucker for anything time related because it really just kind of gives you a full perspective. Like, you'll see in the trailer, like the older versions of Hanks and Wright, that's later in their lives. And just the juxtaposition between the youthful nature of who they were when they first met and then the life that's lived. And Tom Hanks said something in my interview about like, we don't even realize like that we're living in, like right now, this moment that we're in at this moment is going to be the past. Yeah. At some point.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a devastating thing to think about, which is wild. Yeah.
I'll go one step further. And again, to bring it back to Savannah, you guys know, if you've been listening to the show, the Savannah Film Festival has been like a staple in our family's history, right? Like, we come every year. So now Michelle has these Facebook memories that are popping up that are timed to this time.
Yeah, of course.
Of when the festival is taking place. And it's the evolution of the boys.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And there's a square in downtown, is Ellis Square in downtown Savannah, where we would bring a football and throw a football to each other. And I've got pictures of these little boys becoming teenagers, you know, and just in the same spot. And it's a spot that we keep coming back to. And you talk about how quickly time goes. And when we were doing that, when they were little, we would say, you know, one time we're going to come back here and the boys are going to bring somebody, you know, with them. There's going to be someone. And this year, PJ brought his girlfriend for the very first time. And it's like
wild.
And I turned to Michelle and I said, hey, you remember when we said that? Remember when we talked about how one day there's going to bring someone else with them? And I was like, now it's happened. Now we're in it.
You didn't even realize that was going to be the past. It's just a wild thing.
And it was, to me, it was yesterday. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was yesterday, and it's 11 years or something like that.
I mean, we're getting old. I mean, Sean's been old for years, but we're getting older. You know, it's
in all seriousness, Kevin, I think, you know, obviously you just turned 40 recently. I'll be 37 in a couple of months. I feel like we're kind of just at that first point in life where we really are sort of pausing and like that. I think it's sort of that first moment where you can realistically really pause and go, oh, wow, time is actually. I get what everyone always says about time going by fast.
But then Denzel tells you he's got underwear.
Denzel told me I look 46 years old.
No. Well, first off, he told you he has underwear older than you are.
Yeah.
He's currently wearing underwear.
And my knee-jerk reaction was, you should change your underwear.
But then he did call you 46.
Oh, that makes me so happy. It's funny because what this came from was I made a lot of references to the amount of times that I've interviewed Denzel, which is a lot. I've interviewed Denzel for a very, very long time. He interpreted that as me saying I'm old.
Yeah.
So near the end of our interview, he says something about he's, oh, man, I got underwear on older than you. And so I say, you should change your underwear. And then he's like, what are you? Hold on. Let me look at your hair. What are you? 46. And I was like,
that's my favorite part. My favorite part is that he referenced. He goes, let me look at your hair.
I go, no, I'm 46. And he goes, well, you're the one saying you're so old. I said, I didn't say I'm old. I said, we've been doing this a long time. But then, to be fair, he did knee jerk. Whenever I told him what our first junket was, he did walk it back.
Was it, American Gangster?
American Gangster. He did walk it back.
Yeah. I will always have him calling you 46. I'm going to play that.
I knew I should have clipped that out. I knew I should have cut that out.
No, never.
Other things happened in the interview, Sean.
All right. So I'm in Savannah, as I mentioned. Last year, Kevin came down to interview Hoyt Van Hoytema.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
That's right. Kev flew himself down to Savannah to be here for that. And what have I seen?
Legend.
So I got a chance to see Steve McQueen's film Blitz, which, Jake, I believe you caught.
I did.
Too.
Yep, I saw it.
You've seen that?
Yep.
I can't say I was disappointed in it, but it's just fine.
I think it's a very good version of a movie you've seen before.
Yeah, I don't even know if I agree with that.
You don't? I see it too. I got very Empire of the Sun vibes.
I mean, I'm sorry. I'm pushing back on, is it a very good version?
Oh, okay. Okay, it's a well-made version.
It is. Yeah.
It's very well-made. That iPhone money goes a long way.
Yeah, it's just, you know, so during the Blitzkrieg of World War II, when the Germans were dropping bombs on London, there was a movement for families to be able to send the youngest kids away to keep them safe. And so Saoirse Ronan puts her youngest son on a train.
Which is, first of all, it's also crazy that like we're now at a point in life where Saoirse is playing a mom.
Yeah. Incredibly, you know, it's
I mean, the fact that that can now be a thing. Talk about the passing of time.
So she puts her son on a train, and about an hour into the train ride, he's obviously upset that he has to leave his mom. An hour into the train ride, he decides he's going to jump off of the train and then find his way back. And then it becomes the story of, you know, can this young kid get himself back? And Jake, I don't know if you felt this way, but like each of the obstacles that he encountered, it was like escalating obstacles.
Sure.
To the point where I was like, how much bad shit can happen to this kid, you know, in the course of like 24 hours or 48 hours, or however long he's trying to get.
To be fair, it was World War II. A lot is your answer.
I understand. Yes, I understand. A few of them were a bridge too far for me. Like some of the
it just felt like little mini vignettes. It was like 15 minutes with these people. And then he escapes. And then 15 minutes under this circumstance. And then he escapes. And then, and then 20 minutes with these people, and then he escapes.
The movie that I saw down here that is really great is September 5th or September
5th. I've heard really amazing things.
So, and I think right now, currently, this one's flying under the radar because it doesn't necessarily have a big star. The biggest star in the cast is Peter Sarsgaard.
Is it Ruffalo in it?
No. That was Spotlight.
Oh.
And it's set during the 1972 Olympics, the Munich Games, the ones that were featured in Spielberg's Munich, where there was a hostage crisis in the athlete compound, and eight Palestinian soldiers broke in and took Israeli athletes hostage. But instead of looking at the sort of macro impact of that incident, this story is told on the shift of the ABC News journalists who arrived at the control room that day, ready to transmit the Olympic Games that are happening. And then the gunshots ring out and they have to, in the moment, decide how they're going to cover this event as live news. And you have to remind yourself it's 1972. So all of the obstacles that come with that.
Yeah, it's a really intense idea for a movie. Yeah.
Well, to the point of like, they don't have cameras that they can pick up and bring to the location. Hmm. It's like the only cameras they have are on massive stands in the studio.
Yeah.
You know, so how are you going to get a camera close to there? If you're going to report live news, there's one satellite that all the networks share. And it's like, well, NBC has it from this time to this time. So ABC can't break in, you know, and start to report. And they're like the only people who have a team there. There are conversations that they have along the lines of like, and you're an audience member as this is happening. So you're getting information as the people in the newsroom are getting information. And then they have to process what they're going to do and make a decision. And you're in the audience kind of listening to it. And you're like, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. Like one in particular is like, oh, they do figure out how to get a camera on the compound, right? And they can zoom in to this patio where the terrorists keep bringing out the hostages and showing them. And they're like, okay, we've got an angle now. We're showing the patio. And one of the guys goes, what if they shoot one of the what if they shoot one of the hostages? And then they're like, can we even show that on live television? And then it's like a big discussion about, do you keep the camera there? Do you move the camera? How are you covering it? And you're in the audience like, I don't know the answer to that. You know?
Yeah.
And it's still moving forward. So you get caught up in this conversation. There's one point where they're sending in the police, the local German police are sending in people to get close to the thing. And then the guys are in the control room having a conversation saying, wait a second, can they pick this up on the TV in the athletes?
Oh, my God.
And they're like, no, they can't. It's cut off. And they go, no. Every room in the athletes compound has satellite television. So they're able to see. So
wow.
Like, well, are we showing them the police getting close? Yeah. Like they have to make all these decisions in rapid time.
Wow.
So it is a freight train. Like the movie moves faster than anything I've ever. I was just so riveted by it. So riveted by it. It reminds me of, I told the boys, I said, it feels like United 93 mixed with Spotlight.
Wow.
It's like journalism decisions that are having an impact on the moment. And then you could very easily take a step back and say, these are journalism decisions that people should be making right now, are not making right now. You know, like there are a ton of parallels to how news is covered nowadays. And so it's being pushed by Paramount. I think they're going to have a difficult time getting it through the awards race because there isn't really necessarily the main guy. I can't think of his name. But like his biggest role, I think, was he's the boyfriend in Past Lives.
Yeah, I like him.
Yeah.
Yes. He's great in that.
But he hasn't really had like a breakout role, right? Like you can't really hang
John Magaro.
Yeah. That's his name. He's the main guy who's running the control room shift during all this that's happening. And he has to make a lot of the decisions and deal with a lot of the repercussions of this. So anyway, September 5, put it on your radar. I mean, whenever it's coming, I think it's the movie to see. Tonight, the day we're recording this, I'm going to see Anora. Jake has me incredibly pumped for Anora. And,
I loved it. Loved it. And, Kev, have you seen it yet?
Tell the people briefly. I can't wait to see it. I'm seeing it this weekend, I think.
Jakey, what's it about? What's the takeaway from it?
The easy poster tagline is what people are referring to as sort of an anti-Pretty Woman. So Mikey Madison plays this exotic dancer, occasional sex worker, who comes across this rich, spoiled son of, you assume, so sort of very, very rich Russians. Maybe they're wrapped up in some shady stuff. He just falls head over heels for her and pays for her to come over a lot, pays for her to stay for weeks at a time. Basically says, listen, I don't want you to go back to the club. I'll pay you X number of dollars if you stay with me for a week, 2 weeks, come to Vegas with me. Until finally he makes a reference to like, why don't we just get married? Like, let's just get married. She's like, you want to get married? And he goes, yeah, let's do it. Let's get married. So they get married while they're in Vegas. They come home. She makes a big scene about quitting from the club. She, you know, all this sort of stuff. All the other girls are jealous. She does, you know, screw you guys. She goes and lives in her big giant mansion with her new husband, got all this money. And then wouldn't you know it, his parents back in Russia find out that their son, I think is 21, has married what they have been told is a prostitute. So they send their kind of goons to go knock on the door and force them to go get an annulment. And it is it's tense, but it's also the funniest movie that I have seen all year. There is a sequence that takes place in a living room. It's about a 30-minute sequence. It involves the goons trying to get into the house, and then once they get in, trying to deal with her and like being very respectful so as to not hurt her. And also they understand what the circumstance looks like three grown men are in there with this young girl who's screaming. So they're trying to be respectful, but while also wrapping a telephone wire around her to try to tie her up and like keep her quiet, but also being like, I'm sorry, but please be quiet. Please, we beg of you, be quiet. And you know, it's just, you know, and then she starts screaming rape. And he's like, why are you saying rape? Brother, we're not going to do that. Like it's so, so unbelievably funny. Mikey Madison, it's one of my favorite performances of the entire year. Right now, she has my vote for best actress in all the awards that we vote for. It's just, and then, you know, the young boy takes off. So like the rest of the movie is them forcing her to go on a mission around Jersey, like looking for this kid so that they can take them to the courthouse to get an annulment because their parent, because his parents are pissed. It's just, it's great. It's fantastic. The script is honestly, genuinely Oscar worthy. It truly is an Oscar worthy script. It's a phenomenal script. Madison is fantastic. Every hint of talent that she has shown us working in both the Scream series and obviously for Quentin and Hollywood, it comes to fruition. I mean, the story is, and I'm excited to talk to her about this. Sean Baker was in the middle of in a theater watching Scream, and in the middle of the screening leaned over his wife and said, that's who I'm going to write Anora for. And said, I need to get her people on the phone. So I'm excited to find out like what it was about that performance that she thinks, because they're wildly different performance. It's not like you see one and go, oh, that's perfect for the other. Like they're wildly different for performances. So I'm excited. And like I said, I was telling you guys, one of the things I'm going to talk to her about a little bit later today, by the time you hear this, it'll be up on my YouTube channel, hopefully, is that she now has three incredible living room scenes. In Hollywood, Scream, and now Anora. She is the queen of amazing living room scenes. So I'm excited to talk to her about that.
I always loved that her character in Scream and character in Hollywood both get
lit on fire.
Flamethrower.
Yeah, are you gonna ask her about that?
No, I'm not speaking with her. I haven't seen the film.
Okay. Oh,
yeah, I haven't seen the film. But I asked her about that on Scream 5. We interviewed her for Scream 5.
What did she
5,
say?
Like, I'm trying to remember what she said now. But spoiler alert: she gets killed by a flamethrower in both movies, right? Yeah.
So and spoiler 5, alert: and she does not in Enora.
And Hollywood. So yeah.
Well, thank God. Thanks for not ruining that.
If it happened a third time, I'd be like, okay. I feel like you're getting weirdly typecast now.
She puts in the request. I'm sorry. I'll only take this movie if I die at the end.
Flamethrower deaths only.
By fire. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Real Blend. On your way out, hit the comments down below. Let us know your favorite Robert Zemeckis and Tom Hanks collaboration. And we will plug the fact Robert Zemeckis.
What is y'all's? I mean, honestly, mine's Castaway.
Mine's Castaway. Yeah, I think it has to be. I think Castaway is such a brilliant movie.
Yeah, I'll give my answer on next week's show.
Oh, look at McCarthy with the tease. If you're not watching on YouTube, you missed what is now my favorite moment of the episode.
Next week, Robert Zemeckis is going to be joining the show to continue the discussion of here, as well as his filmography. So make sure you guys are tuned in for that. Give the show a like and a subscribe on YouTube. Follow us all the places you get your podcast needs met. Follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. The show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Look, it's the shot from here. It doesn't change, but I move.